Right, please take your Bibles and turn back to the passage we've read earlier. We're actually going to read a little bit more because we're looking at most of chapter 27 as well. Hopefully that won't mean that we're here twice as long for the sermon. But at page 137 in the Brown Bibles, and we're going to read from chapter 27, verse 1 to verse 19. Build an altar of acacia wood, 3 cubits high. It is to be square, 5 cubits long and 5 cubits wide. Make a horn at each of the 4 corners, so that the horns and the altar are of one piece, and overlay the altar with bronze. Make all its utensils of bronze, its pots to remove the ashes and its shovels, sprinkling bowls, meat forks, and fire pans. Make a grating for it, a bronze network, and make a bronze ring at each of the 4 corners of the network. Put it under the ledge of the altar so that it is halfway up the altar. Make poles of acacia wood for the altar and overlay them with bronze. The poles are to be inserted into the ring so they will be on 2 sides of the altar when it is carried. Make the altar hollow, out of boards. It is to be made just as you are shown on the mountain. Make a courtyard for the tabernacle. The south side shall be 100 cubits long, and is to have curtains of finely twisted linen, with 20 posts and 20 bronze bases, and with silver hooks and bands on the posts. The north side shall also be 100 cubits long, and is to have curtains, with 20 posts and 20 bronze bases, and with silver hooks and bands on the posts. The west end of the courtyard shall be 50 cubits wide, and have curtains with 10 posts and 10 bases. On the east end, towards the sunrise, the courtyard also shall be 50 cubits wide. Curtains 15 cubits long are to be on one side of the entrance, with 3 posts and 3 bases, and curtains 15 cubits long are to be on the other side, with 3 posts and 3 bases. For the entrance to the courtyard, provide a curtain 20 cubits long, of blue, purple, and scarlet yarn and finely twisted linen, the work of an embroiderer, with 4 posts and 4 bases. All the posts around the courtyard are to have silver bands and hooks, and bronze bases. The courtyard shall be 100 cubits long and 50 cubits wide, with curtains of finely twisted linen, 5 cubits high, and with bronze bases. All the other articles used in the service of the tabernacle, whatever their function, including all the tent pegs for it and those for the courtyard, are to be of bronze. Well, very detailed instructions we have there. And over the next 30 minutes, we're going to think about what those things teach us about God and about us. Now, I want to assert that every person in the entire world is in search of heaven. They might not call it that. They might not think of it as that. They might think of it as searching for some kind of transcendent experience, maybe a spiritual experience, something that makes them feel like they're really alive. I don't know if you've seen down in Bath at the moment near the bus station, there's an advert, I think it's for the Discovery Channel, and it's a quote from an explorer, and he says, "My only fear is not living my life." As if as an explorer, that the greatest thing he can do, the best experience he can have of the transcendent, if you like, that the fullest life, is to always be on the edge. Maybe up a mountain where he's, you know, on the end of a rope, and his life is just hanging on that thread. And that is living. That's having this transcendent experience. Many people chase after something to reach maybe a state of nirvana, where they're not affected by the stresses of this world. They want peace and transcendence. I found on the internet there is a yoga class you can go to, which is called Heaven Meets Earth Yoga. And there's a website devoted to this, as if in that meditation exercise, that you can find this heaven touching earth. Maybe a common theme in this could be described as looking for peace and freedom. If you've ever been up a mountain, you might have had that experience. I once went up a mountain. Technically, it probably wasn't a mountain because it was in this country. But it was the best kind of mountains we have in this country. It was the day after a blizzard, and there was snow and ice all over this mountain. But the sky was clear. It was just a perfect blue sky. The air was cool. It was beautiful up there to look around. And there was no mobile phone reception. There was no one else with me. And it was very peaceful, very peaceful. And maybe some people live for that kind of experience. People have described flight as there's a poem that describes flight as touching the face of God, as you soar up through the clouds and beyond. Richard Branson is trying to create a business of giving people an experience of going into space and flying so high that they actually experience weightlessness. Maybe that's freedom, you think, going into space. Some people would make that their dream, think that that's the best kind of spiritual experience you can have. Maybe our lives, I guess, are probably slightly different from thinking we'll ever be an astronaut. But maybe you want to chase this peace and this freedom in thinking of a kind of life where you have no washing to do, or there's no crying children in the night. Maybe you try and chase freedom by trying to find a moment just to have a coffee and read a book that you love or a magazine. Every single one of these strategies is ultimately doomed to failure. Again, looking on the internet about where heaven meets earth, I found a holiday review on TripAdvisor. And the reviewer had titled his review, "Escape to Where Heaven Meets Earth." And they gave this wonderful description about the welcome they received and this place where they stayed. And then you can give the ratings, how many stars. And they gave 5 out of 5 for the cost, 5 out of 5 for the food, 5 out of 5 for the service of the staff there. And for the location, they gave it 4 out of 5. And this was a place where they said heaven meets earth. Our strategies of finding heaven on earth are ultimately doomed to failure. You can't go and live on a mountain away from the stresses of this world, and you can't spend your whole life in a yoga studio. Well, tonight we're learning about how God made it possible for him to live with his people. Put simply, God came to live in a tent. And we thought about that a little bit last week. If you just look back to chapter 25, and verse 8. This is the purpose of all of the building work that God wants his people to do. So chapter 25, verse 8 is page 135 of the Brown Bibles. And this is what it says. "Then have them make a sanctuary for me, and I will dwell among them." This is the purpose for this building. It's so that God will dwell with his people. The God of heaven comes down to live with the people that he has rescued from Egypt. He rescued them earlier on in Exodus. You might know the story of Moses and how God brought his people through the Red Sea. He made them his own. He's given them his 10 commandments for how to live. He's put his stamp on them as his people. And now he's saying, "This is how I will dwell with you. I will come and live in this tent." And we're going to look at the implications of that for his people then and for us tonight. We're going to do it in 2 points. They're quite simple. They might seem contradictory at first, but hopefully by the end you'll understand. So firstly, we're going to see we can't get close to God. You can't get close to God. And then secondly, we will see you can get close to God. You can get close to God. So firstly, you can't get close to God because God has to keep you away. All of the instructions for building this tabernacle are there to keep people away from the presence of God. Why? Does that seem strange to you? Why would a God of love have to keep people away? Why would God keep away his treasured possession from his presence? He's worked hard to save them. Now they're his people. He's spoken to them. He said he will live with them. Why does he give instructions for so many barriers to be put up? The barriers are there for their protection. God's keeping them away from his holiness because his holiness will destroy them. And we can see in the way that the tabernacle is designed that God intended to keep people away from him. And we see it both in the construction and in the organization of the tabernacle. Let's think of it like this. If on a car you need a fuel tank, you need that fuel tank to be able to hold the fuel. You don't want any leaks in that fuel tank. If that fuel gets out, then it's very dangerous. There could be an explosion. There could be fire. You're aware that when you have some gas work done on your house, you have to get a registered installer. My uncle put a new central heating system in his house, and I don't know whether he attempted to find a plumber to come and put the boiler in, but eventually he decided he'd just fit the boiler himself, attach it to the gas supply. He knew what he needed to do. He knew that he needed to make sure that there were no gaps, no leaks in the pipes. I think it's actually illegal to do that. However, he's still alive, so he did it successfully. There were no leaks in his gas pipes. The instructions that God gave Moses were very detailed, and they show us that God's intention is that there would be no gaps, no leaks, as it were, no way for someone to casually or accidentally see into the most holy place, no way for the tabernacle to blow over in a storm. No one was meant to see inside if they were standing outside. Just look at how the frame was solidly constructed. If you look down at verses 15 to 25, this is where it talks about upright frames of acacia wood for the tabernacle. Each frame to be 10 cubits long and a cubit and a half wide, with two projections set parallel to each other. These frames of wood were to be overlaid with gold, and you need to imagine something like a goalpost structure. So there were two side posts and a beam going across the top. And this was repeated. There were lots of these, maybe about that far apart, all in a row. And then those beams were standing on heavy bases. Look down at verse 18. Make 20 frames for the south side and make 40 silver bases to go under them. Two bases for each frame. These were solid silver bases. These goalpost-like structures were tied together with tie beams, so going the other way, to make sure that these goalpost-like structures didn't tip over. So what you end up with is something that will have looked a little bit like a cage. So it was made of wood, it was overlaid with gold, very heavy, and it was all tied together so that it couldn't fall over. The coverings are also meticulously described in a way to make sure that the whole frame is covered. So this is verses 1 to 14. We have the description of the curtains. Now, verse 1 uses the word curtain to describe the sheet that was placed over the top of the tabernacle and that went down the sides. Later on, the word curtain is also used for the curtain that would hang at the front of the tabernacle to form the barrier or the entrance into the tabernacle. So fabric was made, finely twisted linen, blue, purple, and scarlet yarn with cherubim. The coverings are to be made as single units. If you see in verse 6, make 50 gold clasps, use them to fasten the curtains together so that the tabernacle is a unit. So it was to be a single entity, tied together with no gaps. There were a total of four layers over the tabernacle. The first layer over this cage-like structure was the linen with cherubim embroidered on. Then over the top of that you had a covering of goat's hair. Over the top of that you had a covering of ram skins. And over the top of that you had, in some translations it says, hides of sea cows. What does it say in the brown one? Does it say sea cows? Yeah. So these four coverings were went over the top of the tabernacle. And they overlapped in such a way to make sure the tabernacle was completely covered. Verse 14. Make for the tent a covering of ram skins dyed red, and over that a covering of hides of sea cows. And it talks about how that the coverings were to, there was excess, so that they could make sure that they didn't just hang down and were the perfect length to touch the ground, that there was excess, so they could make sure that they pinned the coverings right down to the ground. So these were the coverings. Over and above this, there were what are sometimes called veils, or here they're called curtains, which are to mark off the different areas, and they bar entry and prevent access. There were two curtains for the tabernacle. Verse 31 to 37 are the two curtains for the tabernacle. And then in chapter 27, verse 16, there's another curtain, which is one for the courtyard. So there are three curtains in all. So one in the middle of the tabernacle to separate the most holy from the holy. One at the entrance to the tabernacle, which separated the courtyard from the tabernacle. And then one at the entrance to the courtyard. And outside of that was where the Israelites camped. Now, verse 33 is the key verse here in chapter 26. And we looked at this with the children. Hang the curtain from the clasps and place the Ark of the Testimony behind the curtain. The curtain will separate the holy place from the most holy place. This was the curtain that divided the tabernacle into two parts, the holy and the most holy. Now remember from last week, we learned that what God said was that it was above the ark, in the most holy place, in between the cherubim, that he would meet with Moses. That was the spot. That was where God would meet with his people. And the curtain was to separate that place, the most holy place, the ark, from the rest of the things in the tent, to separate God from the Israelites, from his people. So if you're just a regular Israelite from the tribe of Dan, the furthest you could get, the closest you could get, was inside the courtyards. It was just the grounds. Maybe you've been to a National Trust place and you have two options in the ticket price. You can either buy a ticket that gets you into the grounds, or you can buy a ticket that gets you into the building. And maybe as you're going around the grounds, you see all these people going into the building, and you're maybe a little bit envious that they get to go in there. You're just in the grounds. Well, the regular Israelite, most of the Israelite people, they could only just get in the grounds. They could get into this courtyard area. You could wander down to your friend Ben Amni's tent, just down from yours. You could go right in, have a chat, eat with him. You couldn't do that with God's tent. You were kept separate. There was no way in. So you can't get close to God because of your sin. Because God keeps you separate. But secondly, you can't get close to God because God actually lives in heaven. God actually lives in heaven. And this is pointed to in the way that the tent was decorated. The inside of the tabernacle was decorated like the heavens. And it showed people that God lives in heaven, and he's not confined to just a small tent. It showed them that this tabernacle was a picture of something greater. The tabernacle was a copy of the heavenly dwelling where God lived. God wasn't just inaccessible to the Israelites just because there was a curtain in the way. God was inaccessible to them because he actually lives in heaven. And who can decide that they will go up to heaven to meet with God? No one. The pictures that will have been seen inside the tabernacle and the embroidery is described in verses 1 to 6, where it says, to make linen with blue, purple, and scarlet yarn with cherubim worked into them by a skilled craftsman. And as a priest would stand within the tent, they would see through this gold cage-like structure, this linen that was draped around the outside, and they would see all the cherubim embroidered onto it. And it would be a reminder to them that God lives in heaven. He's worshipped and served by angels. And as the priest would perform his duties, he's, as it were, joining in with the angels in the serving and worshipping of God. The angels belonged in God's presence because they were sinless. They serve God perfectly. And the priests can only come in because of the sacrifices that will have been made. We'll see that as we get to chapter 29. Sacrifices have to be made so that the priests can enter in. And it's because sinners don't naturally belong in God's presence. Do you remember, right back in Genesis chapter 3, how Adam and Eve were driven away from God's presence after they had sinned against him? And we're told that a cherubim, an angel, was placed at the entrance to the garden with a flaming sword to prevent their return. Now, whilst all the three curtains were similar, only the one separating the most holy place was to have cherubim, or angels, embroidered onto it. So as you stood in the holy place and you looked towards the most holy place, what was in front of you, barring access, was a curtain with cherubim on it. The Eden imagery is stark. We can't get close to God because of our sin. Because the way is barred, there is no way through. So we can't get close to God because we're sinners. Maybe you find that concept offensive, that, well, I haven't done anything particularly bad. Why would I be barred from the presence of God? Maybe you think that, well, I come to church. Why would I be barred from the presence of God? Maybe you think that you've lived according to this society's rules, that you've been true to yourself. And as you've lived, you haven't gone against anybody. You haven't hurt anybody else. The problem is that we're all in the same situation. We're all in the same boat. The rebellion that was shown in Adam and Eve, in wanting to live life their own way, in being their own rulers, in charge of their own destiny, that attitude is present in each one of our own hearts. We want to live life our own way. We want to be in charge of our own destiny. And that is what the Bible calls sin. And that is what bars us from the presence of God. So that will have been very clear to the Israelites. You can't get close to God because the way is barred and because God actually dwells in heaven. Well, the second thing we're going to see is that we can get close to God. And we can get close to God for two reasons. Well, before we do that, we'll think about some of the implications of us not being able to get close to God. Firstly, one of them is this. We can't get close to God because our minds can't fully comprehend him. You see, God doesn't live in a single geographic location. He can't be confined to a box. He's bigger than a space 15 cubits square. His glory fills the heavens and the earth. Our minds can only understand just a small portion of his infinite character. We can understand him rightly and correctly, but we can't understand him fully. You can count to a finite number, but you can't count to infinity. You can fit the ocean, you can fit part of the ocean in a bucket, but not all of it. The second implication that we see is that God is gracious. God is gracious to his people. He's kind in keeping the Israelites at a distance so they won't be killed. God knows he's holy. He knows his people are sinners. Maybe you remember the account of the man called Uzzah. He was helping King David to transport the ark from one place to another. He thought the ark was going to fall off the cart it was travelling on, and he reached out his hand to stop it falling off, and he touched it, and God struck him dead. God's holiness cannot tolerate sinners. God is coming as close as possible to live with his people, and yet not so close that they die. If you live near a fire, it will keep you warm. Get too close, and it will kill you. The third implication is that you and I don't have what it takes to get close to God. The presence of God can only endure perfection, and that is not us. I wonder if you've ever been locked out of your own house. It's very frustrating. You're at the door. If your keys got stuck or you've lost your keys, you just simply can't get in. It's your house. There's no one else in there. You own it. You own everything in it. It's your house, but you're barred from entry. If anyone should be able to get in that house, it should be me. Maybe that's your attitude with God. You think, if anyone should be allowed into God's presence, it's me. Why would I be shut out? And for each one of us, we're shut out because we don't belong. Not one of us belongs there. God's holiness cannot endure sinners. So, that's the first thing. You can't get close to God. Now for the second thing, more briefly, you can get close to God. Now, this might seem contradictory, but bear with me. You can get close to God because a curtain is an entrance. We thought with the children, didn't we, that a door has two functions. You shut a door to keep people out. You open it to let people in. At night, you'll go around your house locking the doors. I do that in my house. I don't want just anybody walking in to our house in the middle of the night. The door is closed. But this afternoon, when we had people for lunch, the door was open when people were coming in because people were welcome. We wanted people to come in. We'll think about when we have church at Old Down Community Centre in the mornings. We try to make sure that we get the door programmed correctly so that when someone walks towards the door, it will automatically open for them. I think we've got there. But the reason we do that is because we want people to come in, don't we? When the doors are locked, people can't get in. They have to knock on the windows or try and find a different entrance. Now, each of these three curtains that are in the tabernacle, so remember, there's the curtain between the most holy place and the holy place. There's the curtain in front of the tabernacle, which is the tent. And there's a curtain at the entrance to the courtyard, which was just a barrier going around the outside. And each of those curtains was there both to shut people out and to let people in. The tabernacle was a place to meet with God. And in chapter 26, verse 36, and chapter 27, 16, the curtains are called entrances. So 36 is the entrance to the tent, and 27, 16 is the entrance to the courtyard. Now, if no one was ever meant to go in, the tents will have been made of one complete piece, going over the whole top and all around the sides, wouldn't they? There would be no way in. It would just be a tent. It would be a covering. It would be a container. I once went on a holiday to, I think it was a Butlins resort. And this resort was right next to the beach. And it was meant to be, a nice beach holiday. This was a beach resort. But when you're in the resort, you go towards the beach, and there's a big fence there. And I spent absolutely ages going up and down this fence just looking for an entrance to the beach. I thought the whole point of going on a beach holiday was so that you could go to the beach. It seemed pointless. There wasn't any way to get from the resort onto the beach. You know, who would build a house without any doors? It's pointless. It's not a house, is it? It's not a house if it doesn't have a door. So this tabernacle was built so that there was a way in. There were entrances. So the question is actually, who was allowed in? And why were they allowed in? As part of my work, I work up at the Airbus site, and at my security clearance, you have a badge to let you through the doors. My security clearance has lapsed. So what it means really is that I'm only allowed in the reception area. That there's three areas. You can go into reception. Anybody of you could walk into reception. You'd be welcome. You could talk to the people on the desk. If you wanted to go through the turnstiles, you wouldn't be allowed. Now, if you were visiting someone who worked there, then you could get a security pass, and that would get you through the turnstiles. But you couldn't get any further. You're still in the kind of reception area. You're just the other side of the turnstiles. But if you have full security clearance, like Dom, who works at Airbus, you're allowed into the reception, you're allowed through the turnstiles, and you're allowed to go through the doors so that you can work, you can serve, you can enjoy the coffee shop. There's that security clearance needed to get through those barriers. And it's the same here. There's a security clearance required for them to be able to enter and go through. So what clearance is it that's needed? What is the key? Well, this is where the altar comes in. The key is the blood. The key is the blood. The altar was where blood was shed to cleanse from sins. There was no access without the shedding of blood. And we'll see that more clearly in chapter 29, that it was only the priests who allowed into the tent, but only after they had been made clean from their sin. And they were made clean from sin by the killing of animals and then the burning of the animal's flesh on the altar. You see, God's response to sin in his presence is the death penalty. That's why he's keeping his people at a distance. That's why it's his grace. He's being kind. In a sacrifice, the animal is dying instead of the sinner. So in this way, the priest could go into the tabernacle with the penalty for their sins already paid for. They were safe. They were safe. Maybe you're familiar with the shuttles that are used by NASA to go up into space. When the shuttles come back, coming through the atmosphere, they're going so fast that just the speed of going through the atmosphere actually makes the surface of the shuttle heat up incredibly hot, and they have special tiles to protect the shuttle. You'll know that the shuttle isn't just a metal shell. It has windows, and those windows also have to be able to withstand that high heat. And there's something put over those windows which is called the propitiatory layer. The propitiatory layer. What happens is this. As the shuttle comes in, that layer burns up and it's completely destroyed. So that by the time the shuttle is inside the atmosphere and it's slowed down, that layer is completely gone. And the windscreen underneath it is perfectly intact. What this sacrifice is sometimes called a propitiation. It's the punishment and the anger being taken out on the animal instead of the priest. And that's what was happening. Now, the altar wasn't inside the tabernacle, it was outside the tabernacle, but within the courtyard, within these boundaries. It was in between the entrance to the courtyard and the entrance to the tabernacle. That was in the middle. And the altar will have been the focal point for all of the activity that happened in the courtyard. This was the main experience for the common Israelite coming to the tabernacle. We thought, didn't we, how if you're just a regular Israelite from the tribe of Dan, you could only go into the courtyard. And what you will have seen was this altar. It was large, 2.3 meters square. This table is probably not quite 2.3 meters, so larger than that and square. It was made of bronze. The bronze overlaid the wood, and it had four horns, one on each corner. It's not explained exactly what those horns are for. It could have been just a practical purpose to tie up the animals before they were sacrificed. Horns are often, in ancient culture, symbolic of power. It may have had something to do with that. But what was obvious to an Israelite looking on was that it was the death of a substitute that allowed entry into God's presence. The courtyard will have been full of animals. There will have been a smell much like a farmyard. There would have been a noise like a cattle market. There would have been blood on the altar, around the altar, and there would have been the smell of cooking meat. There would have been people walking in with sheep, bulls, goats, pigeons, and only the people were coming out alive. And all of that served as a continual reminder to the Israelites that access to God was only through the death of a substitute. So this has a number of implications for us. Number one, God is accessible. God wants to be known. God wants to be in relationship with human beings. The idea of a God who remains distant from the real world is foreign to the truth of the Bible. God is not elusive. He can be known. We can be in relationship with him. That's the first implication. When God made man, he made a garden for him to live in. We're told that he walked with him in that garden, with Adam and Eve. They were in relationship together. And now God gives his people instructions for a tent as a place to meet him, so he could live with them. And then this God of the heavens stepped down into the confines of a virgin's womb so that he could make himself more fully known to us. Paul, the Apostle Paul in Colossians wrote this, "For in Christ all the fullness of the deity lives in bodily form." And then in John chapter 1, verses familiar at Christmas, it says, "The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth." God is accessible, not because we can get to heaven, but because he comes from heaven to meet with us. The second implication is this. The key to access is the blood. We looked at this over Easter. In Colossians again, Paul says this, "For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross." When Jesus died and the blood poured out of his wounds, the curtain in the temple was torn in two. This wasn't a tabernacle anymore that the Israelites worshipped in Jerusalem. It was a stone temple. But this curtain remained, a big thick curtain separating the most holy place from the holy place. And that most holy place, the place where God's presence was, where he dwelt, that was inaccessible and unknown to anyone except the high priest, was now open. God's presence is now open for anyone who would come to him via the cross. That's anyone here as well. And just like the animals on the bronze altar, Jesus dies, and we walk on in to that presence, alive and safe. Jesus bore that red-hot anger, that burning anger against our sin that we could not and dare not bear ourselves. So let's keep reminding ourselves of that. It was central to the worship of God at the tabernacle. It needs to be central to our life together as God's people. In a few moments, we're going to be celebrating the Lord's Supper together. That's exactly what we're doing. We're reminding ourselves of Jesus' death on the cross, where he bore the anger against our sin. We want this to be central in our services, in the songs that we sing. We want them to remind us of how we are sinners and how we only have access because of the blood of Jesus. It needs to be central in how we relate to one another, as we thought about this morning, forgiving one another just as Christ has forgiven us. And then a third implication is this. Someone who asks God to accept Jesus' death as the payment for their sin now has VIP permanent access to God at any time. Later on we'll see that it was only the high priests who could enter the most holy place. We don't live in that time anymore. The way is open and it will not be closed again. Jesus has promised to dwell with you by his Spirit till the end of time. Your prayers are heard. You're always welcome. We thought at the beginning about ways people chase after an experience of the transcendent, to somehow get an experience of heaven. If you want peace, Jesus has made peace between us and God. It's a peace that cannot be undermined by anything that this world throws at us, by anything that happens in this life. In the middle of the night, with crying children, that peace is still there. In the wake of unemployment, that peace cannot be undermined. Even in the face of death itself, that's a peace that cannot be disrupted or taken away. If you want freedom, live life to its fullest. Well, through Jesus' blood, we have freedom from sin. We have freedom to live in God's presence, to relate to Him, to pray to Him, to enjoy Him. It's a freedom that can endure the loneliest prison because we have access to the throne room of God. It's a freedom that will last forever because Jesus will make a new heaven and a new earth where we will dwell with Him forever.